From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In a secluded valley in Montana, a place of deep forests and few roads and a population of grizzly bears, there's a conflict over a hiking trail. The conflict is between two different groups of people, both of whom would consider themselves nature lovers, even environmentalists. One group of people wants to go to this magical wilderness and experience it for themselves, and the others, they think they should stay the hell out and leave the valley to the bears. Scott Carrier brings us that story later this hour. Now, Lisa Brennan Jobs has written a book called Small Fry, and in many ways it's a memoir with a pretty familiar theme, the absent parent. In her case, about a father who for years rejected and even denied their relationship and his duties. When Brennan Jobs was a child, she and her mother, a very young mother, lived near the poverty line, even as that father, Steve Jobs, was becoming a king of Silicon Valley. Lisa Brennan Jobs has avoided cooperating with writers portraying Steve Jobs, biographers, profile writers. She wanted to tell her own story with all its pain, and after many years, a reconciliation. She's published her memoir to largely excellent reviews, but she told me there's still the lingering feeling that she wished her first book had been about something, anything else, so that it could be completely her story and not the story of the man whose legacy we're all carrying around in our pockets. I asked her to read from the book's introduction.
3 months before he died, I began to steal things from my father's house. I wandered around barefoot and slipped objects into my pockets. I took blush, toothpaste, two chipped finger bowls in Celadon blue, a bottle of nail polish, a pair of worn patent leather ballet slippers, and four faded white pillowcases, the color of old teeth. After stealing each item, I felt sated. I promised myself that this would be the last time. But soon, the urge to take something else would arrive again, like thirst.
Now, you begin this book in the way that you do. Why?
I guess it makes me an active participant in the book. One thing that happened when I started writing is I was disappearing in the pages. I was writing about my parents and different things that had happened, and I couldn't... Other people who read it said, I can't quite locate you. And I think there was a feeling of... Like, am I allowed to write my own story when I have such a famous father?
And what are the implications of that? What does that mean?
I knew it was going to be taken in a direction. I knew I was writing a coming-of-age story about a girl, but that it was going to be twisted into the story of a famous man. I wanted to write a coming-of-age story about a girl growing up in California in the 80s and 90s because I felt like it was a universal story. So we were moving a lot and looking for homes.
You moved some incredible number of times.
Yeah, it was 13 times before I was seven.
Right.
And there was also, even in the homes I was in, a search for a feeling of belonging and being inside and being impossible to push out. Yes, one of the homes was a mansion. Yes. Like, he's so famous, but it doesn't change the fact that we were searching for, that I was searching for a home. And I was hoping that I would have inspiration to write another book first, so that perhaps that would dull or numb the fact that I have someone so famous in this family I'm writing about.
And why didn't you write a first
book
about something else?
Because this one kept on coming up. And I think a lot of novelists and...
Coming up meaning what?
Coming up to be expressed. There were stories that kept on, oh gosh, I got...
You had to do it.
I had to, and I think this is common, even with novelists where there's a story maybe that has to come out first that then opens the way for other stories. And I felt like that. And also I was hoping, then the second thing I was hoping is I was hoping that my father would be like incredibly dull on the page.
I'm afraid that didn't happen.
And then it didn't happen.
No,
he was
it didn't
interesting.
Happen.
And I was like, oh gosh, he's going to steal my thunder. No.
Steve Jobs is the father, often the missing father, the father that
rejects you for a long time. Much later, it invites you in. There are moments of real cruelty, some of it mindless, some of it you ascribe to immaturity on his part. But it's tough. It's really tough. And what was that like to re-experience every day over your desk?
So this is what I was thinking. You have this thing with memoir where you're going back and you're writing about it again, and you're pulled back into these feelings and these times. But at the end of the day, I got to put down the pen and then go back to my life. I mean, it's like the fantasy of control, right?
Mastery of the past.
Right, so I got to go back and live in the past and elongate the good moments and maybe even elongate the bad moments to really figure out what they meant to me and suffer through them. But I still had control over them ultimately. And I had perspective control. I could see them from the point of view of an adult and a child. I guess that was the purpose of it.
For a long, long period of time, you certainly had no relationship to your father, no acknowledgement from a father. To what degree was he spoken of at home with your mother?
So,
and how?
There were so many discoveries that I made when I was writing the book, right? One of the discoveries was how my mother had left this space open for him to come back. She'd known him since they were both very young, and she knew who he was. And so there was you don't forget that. You don't forget when you know someone who they are. And so she wasn't doing it in some sort of strategic way. Oh, I don't want to turn Lisa against her father. She just genuinely did not want to turn me against my father because she knew that deep down he cared about me.
He was not exactly generous in the early years in terms of providing for you.
No, he was absent in the early years. Mostly my relationship was with my mother, and that was so intense. You know, it was so close the way often only children and their parents are, and then made closer by the fact that we didn't have money, so we were like bound together, you know?
Us against the world.
Yeah, it was a bit us against the world, and I think, and then, I mean, now I have a child and I just think of how, you know, she had to walk to the laundromat to wash the cloth diapers when they were dirty, you know, one set. It's like, oh my gosh.
And worse, yeah. and far worse. But how do you make sense of why couldn't he have helped more? I mean, people get split up, they get divorced, but very often they do for each other what they can.
Certainly, I don't think it was a money question. You know, it was emotional. I think he wasn't ready to be a father. My parents were both very young when I was born.
How old?
And 23. And I was not planned for her. And perhaps he was angry about my arrival, so he wasn't around. And I feel there's some credit due that he came back. You know, I think that was hard.
What got him back?
I don't know. But my mother said something like, when his work life was not doing as well, you know, because at that point he'd been kicked out of Apple, and I think that left an opening for him to look around and notice that we were around. And then he put some effort into getting to know me, really true effort. And I think it was probably a pretty courageous thing because I don't think he really knew how to be around a kid.
Mm-hmm. So the Steve Jobs that comes out of popular imagination, you get the sense of a visionary, a certain kind of genius. A really difficult, difficult guy, at times cruel, self-centered, moments of kindness, I guess, but they're eclipsed by the other stuff most often. He's gone. This book is accomplished. How do you see him?
I have so many answers to that. The way that you just read he came off was from the other things that you read, not
Absolutely.
From my book.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious how mine is different from those for you.
Because it's a book about you.
Right. I thought so, too.
It's a book about you.
Yeah. And how does he come off differently?
Well, I there are moments where I want to hit him.
More than before.
Well, because it's coming from a kid who's palpable on the
page. Right, right. So it's like,
Shouldn't
it's not I? Necessarily a different character that I'm describing. It's just that it's visceral now.
I think that's fair.
I've tried to understand why this reaction has been strong, because I feel like he's been so well covered. It's like,
yeah.
And that there are moments of joy, tenderness, sweetness, care in this book between the two of us that are nowhere else, right?
Well, so, maybe it's because people feel a certain sense of, it's very strange to me in a certain way, relationship and ownership to this guy who's now been dead for a while.
Yeah.
Because he's in their pockets.
Right.
He's on their desks.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's a very odd thing. People feel they have ownership. And here you come into the world, the daughter who has been treated badly or rejected or and forgotten in the early years, and then a very complicated reconciliation
yeah.
and relationship develops.
Yeah.
And there's even on his deathbed, maybe you should tell us about what happened when he was very sick.
Yeah, so we kind of had a Hollywood moment. I went back to see him before he died, and he was apologizing fiercely for a weekend and crying. And it was, and saying, I owe you one, which seemed like such an odd phrase.
What does I didn't owe
know how
you
to
one
mean? I don't know. I didn't know how to make sense of it, really.
Yeah.
I said to him, if we could do it again, then maybe next time we could be friends. Because we liked each other. We would laugh together. It was fun when we were friends. But also, I meant, not your daughter, please, next time. Like, that was hard.
Yeah.
And he was saying the same thing. God, it was hard. It was so hard.
It wasn't too little,
so
too late?
Here, no, well, it may have been, and it was. I don't want to sound, it's hard to say it was too little, too late, because it's been so glorious that it happened, right? But yeah, it was cathartic, but it was also hard to be in the moment at the time. I remember thinking, okay, I guess I'll need to save this for later. Like many of these memories, you kind of are confused and you box them up. So, but I think the process of writing the book was that unboxing.
Maybe a last question, and it's about this, about inheritance. What do you have of your mother's and what of your father's, and in what ways?
Oh God, I was so worried you were gonna ask me about money.
I mean it in a much different sense, yeah.
What do I have of my, it's like,
Was there too little of him to derive enough of him? The book is about this in some sense, not getting enough of someone.
And I think sometimes the famous guy is a little distracting, just because.
The famous guy in the corner over there.
The famous guy in the corner over there wearing the black mock turtleneck.
Yeah.
Because don't other people feel this way about the complicated figures in their own lives? Like, isn't there sometimes a longing for people who are even around?
Mm.
Isn't there sometimes a multiplicity of feelings for people who you love? I imagine other people have similar feelings, even though, you know, my father was so famous. Or maybe another way to put it is that everyone's complex family is unique.
No matter who it is.
No matter who it is.
Lisa Brennan Jobs. Her new memoir is called Small Fry. Ahead this hour, I'll talk with Jill Lepore about American history. Her new book takes in absolutely all of it, and we're going to talk about some of the important bits. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In our political climate, arguments about the past are absolutely everywhere. Look at the turmoil over Confederate monuments or on the limits to immigration. Think about the president's call that we should make America great again versus the progressive view that we are always somehow trying to make America better. Jill Lepore has been writing for the New Yorker about our current political struggles, but always with the long view of a historian. An inner day job, when she's not writing pieces for us, Jill's a professor of history at Harvard University. And in a brand new book called These Truths, she's tackled the entire American story. And it's a remarkable undertaking. Jill, let me start with the obvious. You've decided to do a survey of over 600 years of American history, from 1492 to last week.
The obvious but the inexplicable.
Well, that's it. That's it. What possessed you? Why did you tackle something so ultimately expansive?
Partly, I really can't turn down a dare. This is a bad thing to confess. A. B.
What was the dare? Who dared you?
Norton, the publisher. And then I really, really, really thought, damn, I wish there was a book like that. And I decided someone should try.
Well, this book, which is filled with all kinds of triumphs and achievements and all the rest, but it opens with some really grim statistics. And you write, between 1500 and 1800, roughly 2.5 million Europeans moved to the Americas, and they carried 12 million Africans there by force, and as many as 50 million Native Americans died, chiefly of disease. And so I suppose it illustrates one of the unfortunate realities of history, which is that most of the people affected by major events didn't have much of a choice in them. How has powerlessness informed the study of America and the story of America?
What I argue, and what this is actually something I came to believe on, again, like kind of freshly reading the evidence, was that it is actually the assassination of worlds. It is that slaughter, those atrocities, that enslavement, that profound loss and suffering that is a crucible of violence that makes possible the ideas on which this nation is founded. As horrible as that is, the beauty of the idea that all humans are equal, that we are born with inalienably with natural rights, that the people are sovereign and they give their consent to be governed, these ideas are actually made possible by the protests made by the powerless during that, in the numbers that you cite there. So I give a lot of causal weight to slave insurrection, runaways, enslaved people who run away, wives and servants who flee, to apprentices who run away, to native peoples who wage wars or in other ways resist the taking of their lands, that it is that sort of the ceaseless question in the ferment of that violent, that world of violence, where people just keep saying again and again and again, by what right have you taken my labor and my life and my freedom? And that it's that conversation that sparks all this political thought that makes possible, say, American independence. And that doesn't make American independence less magnificent in terms of the power of those political ideas. Their origins are darker and more complicated. But then I think one reason that's useful to think about is then we all have ancestors in that story.
A lot of what the book is about is about who counts as an American. And when you look at the contemporary headlines, say, about immigration, whether it's detention centers for kids or mass deportations or what's colloquially called the Muslim travel ban, how does that all fit into the American story that you're telling?
I think immigration restrictionists cannot find a lot of support for their position in the record of the American past. They have their political forebears do not come out well in any fair assessment of the seeking of freedom and justice and equality in a democratic society in the American past. And I come out differently on that question than I do say about fundamentalism, with which I gained a lot of sympathy here, not being a fundamentalist myself. The immigration restrictionists have a very uncomfortable legacy to wrestle with. Importantly, there are no federal laws restricting immigration until the 1880s. I mean, fully a century after the founding of the country, you can just come into the country. Like, like open borders are the most scandalous thing in American history. No, they're not. They're actually the founding ideal.
Jill, one of the figures you write about is a woman named Mary E. Leese, a woman I'd never heard about before. And you say that she helped bring the moral crusade into American politics. Who was she and how did she do that?
Yeah, she's a pretty fascinating person. So she was a Kansas farmer. She was a farmer's wife. She had, I don't know, six kids. I think most of them died. She, there was like sod farmers in Kansas, lost everything in the Depression of 1873, as so many Americans did. gave herself basically a college education by reading stuff that she pasted to the wall that she could read while she was doing chores. She eventually, you know, she studied the law. She ran for office. She eventually became a journalist and worked for Joseph Pulitzer. But she was probably the most famous speaker on the populist speaker circuit before William Jennings Bryan, the great populist demagogue of the late 19th and early 20th century. She, like many poor farmers in places like Kansas and Nebraska, looked at the economic development in the second half of that after the Civil War and said, this is just a conspiracy of the government and railroad companies. They've declared corporations to be people, and they're giving corporations all these benefits, and poor farmers can't make a living. And the people have lost all their political power. And one of the ways she thought that could be remedied was by getting women the right to vote. And there, we tend not to pay much attention to how much populism was aligned with a certain strain of suffrage in the 19th century. She was very tall, so people always describe her as an Amazon. And I love her because she said, man is man, but woman is superwoman. Just like, she had this like great 19th century idea about women's superiority. Like, she's just very, very interesting, and she's compelling. She was anti-Semitic. She ended up writing this kind of crazy, insane manifesto about white supremacy at the end of her life. Like, she's a much discredited character for many, many reasons, but you can't just like scratch her off. So she comes out of that crusade that abolitionism is a female crusade, temperance is a female crusade, woman suffrage is a female crusade, populism becomes a female crusade, and then it turns into prohibitionism. What happens after women get the right to vote? They don't need to crusade anymore. But by now, the crusade, the moral crusade, is just a great big giant wrench in the American political campaign toolbox. And so other people are like, oh, I'll use that. So Joe McCarthy wages a moral crusade. Barry Goldwater wages a moral crusade. Ronald Reagan's campaign was a moral crusade. It becomes the kind of go-to tool of conservatism.
Is Donald Trump a moral crusade?
No.
I wouldn't think so.
No. No, but he uses the language of a moral crusade. And that's one of the many perplexing things about that campaign. But he is anointed by people who are associated with the moral crusade. You know, Phyllis Schlafly, like her last political act, the very, very end of her life in 2016 is to endorse Donald Trump. That's actually
Phyllis Schlafly, the great anti-feminist.
The great anti-feminist who stopped the ERA. Yeah. She, you know, supports McCarthy. She supports Goldwater. She's right out of the Mary Lee's playbook.
One of the things that took me by surprise, although I know you've been obsessed with it in pieces, including for The New Yorker, is the presence of the media in this book. What is it about early America that made a free press so important, and it's enshrined in the First Amendment, and it's right up there with the freedom of religion? What did that press in early America look like, and how is it radically different from anywhere else in Europe, for example?
Yeah, so this is, you know, to the extent that I have a specialty as a scholar, it really is the history of how we communicate politically. The idea of the freedom of speech and freedom of press has a 17th and 18th century, early 18th century history that really influences our Bill of Rights. But there is also a very particular cast on those ideas that the founders of the Republic make note of. They don't really have no idea where it's going, but they do understand that if people are going to be able to vote for their representatives who will make the laws, that the people need to have enough information to cast informed ballots. And for the people to have enough information to cast informed ballots in this country that is actually quite big, and by 18th century standards, just vast, huge, sprawling, monstrous, they need to have some way to receive ideas other than just the educated gentlemen writing letters to one another.
What was the relationship between leaders and the press early on? Is there any precedent to a president calling us meaning the press, in public, the enemy of the people? Was there that kind of attack or vituperation?
You know, we know what things Andrew Jackson said privately, but the presidents all got pissed off at the press. This is the famous thing of Jefferson saying, is this maybe 1804, you know, every newspaper should be divided into four sections, truths, lies, improbabilities, and impossibilities. You know, like, it's not that he thought that the press was to be believed all the time, but he knew that it was essential, that this is what he says, you know, in his first inaugural address, that the we're all Federalists, we're all Republicans, and what we agree on is that there ought to be a contest of opinion, and that the truth will be found by truth and error having a battle on a fair field.
I can't help but ask, has the national mood ever been this anxious? Obviously, during the Second World War and times of great emergency, there's a different feeling among the people. But this sense of chaos, this sense of every day is going to bring some crazy piece of news, is it comparable to anything in your mind?
So I guess the first corrective I always offer when I'm asked that question is, whose past are you talking about? Like, if we are talking about the American history and all of the American past, and meaning everybody, there is no day before the Emancipation Proclamation that isn't worse than today. Not a single day in all of those centuries. To be born as human chattel and die as human chattel is a worse political state of affairs than the fact that our politicians scream at one another and should never be holding office in the first place. I mean, like, this is a bad day. But if we want to think about the past as all of our pasts, then I think we need to have some sense of proportion. That's not to say we shouldn't be doing everything possible to make the world better now. But I'm just saying, like,
that's totally fair, Jill. And of course, you're right. But does that calm you down as a citizen, as a human being?
You know what I think kind of did this for a lot of people who've been trying to sort of say, well, you know, there's been some bad stuff before, was the detention of babies and toddlers this summer, undocumented immigrants, that in the long epic of the American story, that's not worse than Japanese imprisonment during the Second World War. That's pretty much up there with lynching. Like, that is as great a moral travesty and atrocity as anything done in the name of the American people at any point in our history. And so it's hard to look at that and say, this is an okay time.
Well, there seems to be a push and pull constantly in this history between the forces of forward movement or seeming forward movement and the forces of persistence and regression. So is there always in the course of American history the illusion that you can leave something entirely behind or something has been entirely overcome?
I guess I think that notion of the forward progression itself is the illusion. And I don't mean that in a cynical sense. I mean it in the sense that it's quite important to one side of the argument to believe that the direction that the country is going into is sort of forward in time towards in this kind of march of progress. And then it's quite important to the other side in the political argument often to say that the best times were in the past and we need to return to those, you know, the sort of change we can believe in versus make America great again, that just at the simplistic slogan term we're talking about, moving into the future versus turning to the past. And yet, as ideologically useful as that has been for narrow partisan political battles, I don't actually think it represents the real patterns to be discerned in American past.
Jill, I just can't help but say this. First of all, thank you. And I just can't recommend these truths highly enough. It's the most extraordinary all-in-one volume of American history that I could imagine and certainly that I've ever read. And want to thank you.
Thank you, David.
The title of Jill Lepore's book is These Truths, A History of the United States. You can find more than a decade of her writing for the magazine, from originalism on the Supreme Court to the history of Wonder Woman, at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a minute, we're going to get outside. We're going to enjoy the weather while it's still good and try not to get eaten.
Are you worried about the grizzly bears?
Well, I carried 2 cans of bear spray along the trail. I was in a, you know, heavily wooded area, and maybe 20 or 30 yards out, I heard, you know, a growl. I can't really specifically say if it was a grizzly bear, though. It could have been a wolf. It could have been a cougar.
Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Next week, we're going to hear the story of a man, a very successful businessman, who lost his fortune in a venture, or maybe it was a scam, that not even a child would have fallen for. And years later, his daughter resolved to confront the man who was responsible for it all.
Did you con my dad?
Did I call your dad? Many times I've called your dad.
No, I'm asking, did you con him?
Did I con him? I guess that would depend on the definition of con.
That's next time. Now, our final story today brings us north, northwestern Montana, close to the Canadian border. And in this region of immense forests, there's a hiking trail that's become a source of really bitter dispute. Now, often in stories like this, we find the interests of loggers or developers or ski resorts or dam builders at odds with the views of environmentalists. But in the Yaak Valley, the Pacific Northwest Trail pits nature lovers against nature lovers. Scott Carrier, the producer of the podcast Home of the Brave, recently drove up to the Yaak Valley to try to understand just what's going on.
In America, we have 11 national scenic trails for long-distance hikes through areas of the highest scenic quality. The Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail are the best known, both over 2,000 miles long. National scenic trails are like national parks in that they're designated by Congress and managed by the National Park Service and the National Forest Service. Anybody in the country can go there for a short walk and a picnic, or you can start walking and keep walking for 4 to 6 months until you get to the end of the trail. One of our newest national scenic trails, designated by Congress in 2009, is the Pacific Northwest Trail, the PNT. It's 1,200 miles long, starting on the Continental Divide in Glacier National Park, Montana, just a few miles south of Canada, and running west, roughly parallel with the Canadian border, to the Pacific Ocean in Olympic National Park at the northwest corner of Washington. It's an arduous route, crossing 12 separate mountain ranges. You go up over a mountain range and then down across a river valley, then up over a mountain range and down across a river valley, over and over, like a theta wave, 1,000 miles long. It takes 3 to 4 months to complete, and much of that time, about 30%, you're walking through grizzly bear habitat. This year, the first hiker through on the trail was Justin Schmidt, 22 years old. I met him at the end of June in the Yaak Valley, 180 miles into the hike.
How would you summarize the trip so far?
Miserably exciting. Painstaking, guinea pigging. It can get pretty crazy out there, especially just right now. There's a lot of timber down and there's a ton of snow, probably, you know, 12, 15 foot snowbanks in some places. Can sink right through and twist an ankle pretty easy, I'd say.
Are you worried about the grizzly bears?
Well, I've done a lot of backpacking in bear areas before, and I carried 2 cans of bear spray along the trail. I was in a, you know, heavily wooded area, and maybe 20 or 30 yards out, I heard, you know, a growl. I can't really specifically say if it was a grizzly bear, though. I wish I could, but it could have been a moose. It could have been a wolf. It could have been a cougar.
It may seem kind of crazy to go hiking in a place where you can be mauled by a wolf or a mountain lion or be killed and eaten by a grizzly bear. Grizzly bears are dangerous. But it turns out, people are even more dangerous to them.
You know, an uncontested fact of grizzly bear biology is that human beings are the number one threat to grizzly bears. And that could be through habituating them to food sources, where they then will come into a camp and potentially attack a hiker.
Natalie Dawson is a wildlife biologist.
If a bear gets in a conflict with a human, it usually means that that bear is removed. You know, people like to say, well, we can just relocate bears. But the reality is when you relocate a bear, in many cases, you give it a death sentence because you put it into a new place where it doesn't have a home range and it doesn't know where any food resources are. And so what more often happens is the bear is killed because of the interaction with humans.
Grizzly bears used to occupy most of the western half of the lower 48. One continuous population from Nebraska to California, from Canada to Mexico. Now they live on just 3% of that land in discrete, isolated populations. For example, the PNT begins in Glacier National Park, where there's a population of 700 grizzlies, which is considered to be a healthy population for that area. But just 180 miles west of Glacier, in the Yak Mountains, where I met the hiker Justin Schmidt, the population of grizzly bears is close to extinction.
Grizzly bears are hanging on by a thread, as many people would say here in northwestern Montana. There's less than 25 bears, most likely, in this area, if we consider bears on both the Montana and the Canada side. It's not a lot of bears.
The Yak grizzlies are smaller and more secretive than other grizzly bears, preferring to live in the forests rather than up high out in the open above treeline. The forests in the Yak were extensively logged up to the 1990s. Now the area feels remote, beyond the reach of civilization.
You get up high in a place and you look around and you see no roads, no towns, no lights, no infrastructure, no cell phone towers. And so it's spectacular in that sense. And then with my added lens of looking at things as a wildlife biologist, what I see is a lot of forest with different species and big creek valleys and river valleys that allow for those animals to move from place to place. So it's a really special part of Montana that way.
The things that make it good for bears are exactly what brings people to the wilderness in our boots and our backpacks and our fleece. People like Ron Strickland, who thought up the Pacific Northwest Trail in the first place.
That's correct. I thought up the idea in 1970, almost 50 years ago.
Strickland, now 75 years old, is tall and lean, young at heart. We went for a walk along a section of the PNT where it meets the Puget Sound, north of Seattle, and he still has some spring left in his knees.
I graduated from Georgetown in 65, and I skipped my graduation to go with some buddies, a Iranian fellow and a Japanese classmate, to go to Great Smoky Mountains National Park to thru-hike the AT in the park.
The Appalachian Trail.
Appalachian Trail. And, oh, God, I fell in love with that.
Right out of college.
Yeah. Even in college, I was a member of the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club, and they had a group called the Bushwhackers, and they'd go every weekend.
I would bushwhack. Did you get a badge for bushwhacking?
No, there were no badges, just pleasure, kind of weird pleasure.
Strickland kept hiking farther and farther distances. He went to graduate school and wrote his PhD dissertation on how Congress adds new areas to the national wilderness system.
At that time, America had two famous long-distance trails, the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail. And I had the great desire to go east and west instead of north and south. And people basically didn't believe that we could do this, that we could have a long-distance Pacific Northwest Trail. So we had to prove it to people that we could do it. And we felt strongly that people seeing this would, oh, look, here's some people now. Here are all those people over there.
Yeah.
Look at this nice family, little kids and their dog. This is what America should be, really. Not the news we hear every day about some kind of divisions and that out there, this family doing this. That's my idea of America. And I have provided that for them. Not just me, too. I shouldn't say that. Me and all the volunteers of the Pacific Northwest Trail Association. So I think when I'm out here, it's romantic and something everybody should have an opportunity to share. And I think we need more romance in life.
When Strickland said this, I thought maybe he was using the wrong word, because I usually think of romance as falling in love with another person, but Strickland meant it as falling in love with nature, or the beauty of nature. It's an idea that comes from philosophical romanticism, Rousseau and Kant, William Blake, and here in America, Emerson and Thoreau. It's the idea that civilization, industrialization, ultimately leads us astray and leaves us feeling lost and alone, and that the way to find meaning and purpose in our lives is to go out and have intense emotional experiences in nature, like maybe coming face to face with a grizzly bear. This philosophy was a large part of the impetus behind the modern environmental movement that began in the 1960s. There was also another philosophy involved in the early environmental movement, one where nature does not exist for the purpose of our enlightenment. It's called the land ethic, first proposed by Aldo Leopold in 1949 in his Sand County Almanac. And it says human beings are but members of a greater biotic community, that the air, the water, the soil, and all the plants and animals have rights of their own. Therefore, we need to extend our system of ethics to include other species and whole ecosystems. That's why it's called the land ethic. Perhaps the best example of the land ethic in action is the Endangered Species Act, which passed nearly unanimously in 1973 and now protects over 1,600 species of animals and plants in the U.S., including the grizzly bear. So, there are some environmentalists who don't buy into Strickland's romantic notion of the PNT. They see the land from the perspective of the bear, and that perspective is that humans are dangerous. You could put Natalie Dawson in this camp.
And so it's the question of, do we use or not use what's called the precautionary principle, which is this idea that why do we have to illustrate that there is harm being done? If we know that the potential for harm exists, wouldn't we want to take the least harmful path in the first place?
You'd think this question would have been asked before Congress designated the PNT in 2009. And in fact, it was way back in 1978. Ron Strickland officially proposed the idea to Congress in that year, and Congress thought it was a good idea. But according to law, they had to study the environmental effects of the trail. So they did an environmental impact statement, and this took 2 years to complete, and in the end, the conclusion was that the trail was unnecessary, too costly, and would pose a serious threat to the survivability of the yak grizzlies. Congress said no to Ron Strickland's romantic dream. But Strickland did not stop trying to get the trail approved. He'd learned from hiking how to suffer through hardship and defeat. Ron Strickland was a man who thrived on bushwhacking. So he kept going, working with local groups and lobbying members of Congress year after year, until 2009, when he was able to get a proposal attached to an omnibus land bill. And this time, it passed. Except it passed without any further environmental review. Nobody stopped to ask if the trail was still a threat to the yak grizzlies, and this, according to Rick Bass, was illegal.
You can't make those kinds of decisions without an environmental analysis and an environmental impact statement. That's just a code of law. That's the law. And it's legal to have midnight riders on last-minute pieces of legislation. What's done is done, but that doesn't make it right ecologically. It doesn't mean that it's not violating the Endangered Species Act.
Rick Bass is a prolific writer and environmental activist who lives in the Yak Mountains. He has a house deep in the woods where he's produced 4 novels, 4 novellas, 5 collections of short stories, 16 nonfiction books, and maybe 1,000 letters to Congress asking for protection of the yak grizzlies. First, protection from logging encroachments in the 80s and 90s, and lately, protection from the number of hikers that may be coming through the Yak Mountains on the PNT.
We are standing knee-deep in the midst of an explosion of industrial recreation. I don't judge industrial recreationalists. I am one. We all are. You know, we have gear, we have boots, we walk in the woods. But we have to be responsible. We have to be accountable. You can't maximize outdoor recreation potential without costing something else. America is no longer about maximizing anything. We need to learn humility. We need to learn accountability. We need to learn responsibility. We need to know that there is more to life than maximizing outdoor recreation potential. My dog in the fight is grizzly bears. We have maybe 20 left in the valley. Between 19 and 25 is the most accurate estimate. Very small population, and any conservation biologist will tell you when a population gets that low, it's really, really hard to recover it.
Why do you care about grizzly bears? Why are you putting so much on the line for them?
They make me feel alive. You know, in a world of increasing detachment and distraction and benumbedness, when you go out in the woods where there are grizzly bears, you're humbled, you're respectful, you're engaged, all of which to say you're the best part of being alive.
Ron Strickland believes Rick Bass is just being selfish.
We're not harming the bears, and I'm very much in favor of grizzly bears and wildlife in general, but the trouble always had to do with Rick Bass, and Rick Bass didn't come into the country until 87. You can see that in his book, Winter. It's in the beginning. He says he'd been in Mississippi and Texas. He was from Texas, and he came into the country with his girlfriend in, I think, the autumn of 87. And I think the feeling of anybody who goes there is, whoa, I've discovered something really great, and I'd like to keep this the way it always was when I first arrived. And he always says that there was this guy back east who drew a line on a map, and he'd never been in the area, and that he's responsible for this disastrous proposed trail.
Meaning you.
Meaning me. He always says that. That's always his thing. Elizabeth,
does that hurt your feelings?
At first I thought it was funny because it's so not true. You know, I was there working on this project well before he came. And I think my project is less NIMBY. My project is not NIMBY at all. I don't even live there. You know, I think of him as a NIMBY person. You know, I actually like Rick Bass. I've known him for years. So I actually like him.
I've met him.
But the irony of his situation is, and I doubt if he admits it, is that he writes books, articles all the time, always new books and articles about the yak. This attracts a lot of people.
People who read his books.
People who read his books and articles.
Yeah, no, I mean, for sure, my writing has... I know a handful of individuals who've moved here having learned about this place because of my writing, and I feel like they're pretty good neighbors, and so I accept that that charge, you know, and own responsibility for that handful of people, and for the more than a handful of people who come and visit, you know, get a burger or beer, and then head on. And that was a calculated risk. I was aware of the risk when I started naming this place and writing about it and celebrating it and defending it. Being quiet about this place is what had led to it being so savagely mismanaged in the past decades during the timber wars. And being quiet about it sure was not helping. So this is not about me and my backyard or my front yard or my side yard, you know, my million-acre side yard. This is about a population of an incredibly endangered species. It's second slowest reproductive rate in North America, of which we have roughly 20 left. I mean, it's like Noah's Ark. It's biblical. Like, I want somebody to tell me, how many more can we lose? I want to hear somebody say, we can lose one. We can lose two. We can lose three. We can lose four. We can lose five. And the Pacific Northwest Trail is worth it. I want to hear somebody tell me that, and I haven't heard anybody tell me.
Rick Bass's solution to the problem is a compromise. Instead of getting rid of the trail altogether, why not make a detour around the Yak Mountains? There's a route, first proposed in 1978 during the initial environmental study, a route that bypasses the Yak by following the Kootenai River to the south. Unfortunately, there's a highway running along the river and a busy railroad track pretty much the whole way. And National Scenic Trails, by definition, do not follow highways and railroad tracks. Charlie Carpenter is president of the Pacific Northwest Trail Association.
In our view, the proposed route doesn't meet the standards for a national scenic trail. If it's not on the road, it's close enough to the road that you are hearing the road. In northern Montana, a wilderness or near wilderness experience is going to put you in grizzly habitat. The trail starts in Glacier National Park. It's absolutely grizzly habitat. Grizzlies live in the mountains here. When you go in the mountains, you're going in grizzly habitat.
This is true. Grizzly bears live on public land. Anybody in the country can go there anytime. The question is, how many people are too many people? Last year, 65 people thru-hiked the PNT, which is not that many compared to the 1,000 that completed the Appalachian Trail. But then, all it takes is one hiker with Oreo cookies or a picnic basket. I'm not saying hikers carry picnic baskets, but let's say pate or a tin of caviar. Seriously, you just never know how a grizzly bear will react. Perhaps the person who best understands these questions is the wildlife biologist who works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Libby, Montana. His job is to make sure the grizzly bears in the Yak and neighboring Cabinet Mountains don't become extinct.
My name is Wayne Kayswarm. I work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I've been here since 1983 working on grizzly bears.
As the Fish and Wildlife expert on this, the job is to recover the bears. What do you think about the Pacific Northwest Trail going through that area?
Well, it's not so much the trail. It is largely the people and the numbers of people associated with the trail. And, you know, I don't have a good way of predicting exactly how many people are going to use the trail. But where we have large numbers of people, we've experienced problems in the past related to conflicts with bears.
What do you think is too many people?
I can't even put a number on it. And it's not a simple issue here, but that's another part of the puzzle. Unfortunately, the big picture to me is there are no easy choices in this particular case. I mean, there are going to be impacts from the location of this trail wherever it goes. If you get that many people walking through grizzly bear habitat, there are going to be some downsides to it.
Do you have an idea that you think might work?
Well, actually, I don't. You know, and I suppose if it were up to me and I only had bears to consider in the situation, I might choose not to have the trail at all. But I'm not sure that that's a possibility in this particular case. Congress has already designated it.
Yeah.
And so what do I do? I can't, unless Congress changes its mind, I think we're, in a way, we're kind of stuck with it.
It's up to Congress to decide the fate of the Pacific Northwest Trail. Either keep it as it is, or reroute the trail around the Yak Mountains, or just get rid of it altogether. But I think Congress is busy with other issues these days. So it's likely the argument will end up in federal court, where it'll be a fight between the National Trails Act of 1968, which creates long-distance scenic trails like the PNT, versus the Endangered Species Act of 1973, which demands the highest protection for grizzly bears. This is the new face or fate of environmentalism. We create and protect public lands where we can go fall in love with the beauty of nature and wildness, but then just by being there, we end up killing it. We kill the thing we love. Maybe not everywhere, maybe not yet. We still have wild and beautiful places, just maybe sometimes it's better not to go there at all.
That was Scott Carrier, and he reported from the Yak Valley of Montana. That's our show for the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Keep in touch with us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Abe Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill DeBoff, Cal Alia, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann, Johnny Vince Evans, and Jessica Henderson. Scott Carrier's story was produced with help from Anne Milliken. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.